This is the Ocuzyne Brief on UK Health Radio, your real feel-good radio with Peter Hofland.
In this episode of the Ocuzyne Brief, I'm talking with Paul Lavender. Paul is head of education at Cargo Publishers based in the Basel area in Switzerland. And in today's program, we're talking about publishing your research-based studies in a medical journal. So how do you publish your research? In short, it all starts with taking time to explore the journals in your field and reading and above all understanding the instructions to authors. But much more is involved, and in today's episode of the Ocuzyne Brief, we talk about that and more. I'm Peter Hofland, and this is the Ocuzyne Brief. The Ocuzyne Brief is developed in collaboration with our online journal Ocuzyne, where you can find additional information and the latest news about cancer diagnosis and treatment and cancer prevention. Support from the Ocuzyne Brief comes from the Oncology Directory at oncologydirectory.com and from the ADC Directory at adcdirectory.com and from listeners like you. For more information on how to support this program, visit our website at Ocuzyne, and if you're living in the United States and want to receive our newsletter, text the word cancer to 66866, and we will make sure that you'll receive our newsletter, which includes an overview of the latest news in oncology and hematology.
This is the Ocuzyne Brief. For the latest news about cancer and cancer treatment, visit our online journal, Ocuzyne, at www.ocuzyne.com.
On the phone with me is Paul Lavender. He is head of education at Karger. Karger is an academic publishing house based in Switzerland and publishes scientific and medical journals and books, as well as develops educational programs. Paul, welcome to the Ocuzyne Brief.
Thank you so much, Peter. Thanks for the invitation.
So in today's program, we're going to talk about how people can get the results of their scientific or medical studies and research published. Let me start with asking this. How simple, would you say, is it to get your paper published?
It's an interesting question, isn't it? Because now the digital publications are so widespread and people can even self-publish, it's redefined what published means. So to actually get published, anyone can publish their own research from a smartphone, and you can say that it's been published. However, of course, what researchers and authors want is to be published, ideally, in a peer-reviewed journal, and even more ideally, in a peer-reviewed journal with a very solid reputation and a great reach in their field. And of course, as you go up each of those levels, it becomes progressively more difficult to be published.
Before we dive into some of the specifics, and this may be a bit of a loaded question since we're both working for scientific and academic publishers, but if you submit a paper to a journal, can you expect that a publisher is always accepting every article submitted to them?
Yeah, and it is a good question. I think in general, this will vary a lot according to publisher, but if we took an average for the publishing industry, we would probably say 2/3 to 3/4 of submissions are rejected initially. Now, we don't know how many of those submitted papers would then go on to be accepted by another journal because all of these submission infrastructures are not interlinked. But I think every publisher would say the vast majority of papers are rejected for publication. And if you start looking at journals like Nature or the New England Journal of Medicine, you're looking at rejection rates of 90-95%.
That may be a bit of a surprise and maybe a little bit of shocking for many, especially younger scientists, to realize that their research, their paper, may not necessarily be accepted by a journal. And they may not necessarily realize the greatest hurdle of getting published a paper is actually getting it published. But a good rule is that if you want to publish your paper, you really should write that paper with a specific journal in mind and understand their specific submission requirements, right?
This is, I think, spot on. And it's something that perhaps doesn't get taught often enough, that ideally, even before conducting the research, you have a target journal in mind that you think would be interested in publishing that work. A mistake a lot of people make is to perform the research more or less in isolation or in a bubble, And then it's only after that it's written up that they start to find and look for a journal that would be interested in publishing.
So that is addressing the first question about how to get your paper published. Now, let's go to the next step. After completing their research or study, selecting a journal, understanding the journal submission requirements, and writing a final paper, somebody may be ready to submit that paper to a journal. What happens next? What happens immediately after the paper is submitted?
For the majority of journals and the vast majority of journals and publishers, the process is very similar. It's not the same for every single journal. There are exceptions, and those would be in the journal website. But for the vast majority, it's still the traditional publishing model as it was done when journals were in print. What happens is that your paper is submitted through an online portal. And as you've mentioned, Peter, ideally, authors would look very, very carefully at the guidelines and make their paper fit that journal's guidelines, provide all the information that is relevant. So for context, at Carga, maybe 80 to 90% of the initial submissions are actually returned to the authors because of missing information. So it's very important to avoid delay, to go through the guidelines with a fine-tooth comb. When I worked in medical writing, I was a medical writer and editor for a number of years. We used to put 1 to 2 days aside just to go through the guidelines and check the papers were in the correct shape for that particular journal. So it's a time-consuming process, but a necessary one. Then when you get all that into matching the guidelines and you click submit, it goes to an editorial office manager. So the editorial office manager, the main things that they're interested in when they see your paper is, okay, first, at a high level, is this within the scope of the journal? So they won't necessarily be scientifically trained, and they will more and more be using AI tools, but they will look at this and say, okay, does the scope of it at least match what the journal's about? So have you submitted a preclinical paper to a clinical journal? Does it match the guidelines that are on our website? Does it have an ethics statement? Is there IRB approval, if that's required, for this paper? They will also ask questions like, are the references up to date? For example, if the most recent reference is a few years old, they may think this is a paper that has been submitted and rejected multiple times before and not updated. They'll do a quick look at the language. Are there spelling mistakes in the title, for example, or the abstract? And they'll also very likely have a score from an automated plagiarism check. So the key things that person is asking is, okay, does it match the guidelines we've set? First glance, is it ethically okay in terms of the research? Any plagiarism issues? Is it in the scope? Can I pass this on to my editor for a second review without the editor saying, why didn't you spot this or that problem? So it's a first line check.
Now, not everybody submitting a paper speaks English as a first language, right? Some publishers offer an editorial review for non-English speaking people who submit a paper, offer them assistance in writing or editing their paper. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Yeah, a lot of publishers are starting to offer this. For example, at Cargo, we partner with Inago, which is a highly respected editing agency. So authors who come through our submission portal will have the option to submit their paper to Inago for editing at a discounted rate. There's also, and I believe we still have this, a automated check of the paper, and more publishers are introducing this, where AI examines the paper during the submission process and makes a recommendation to the authors about whether language editing is actually required or not required.
Another important fact that authors should keep in mind is that they should only submit original work and not just copy and paste from other published works. And if they quote something, which is totally legitimate, right, it should be correctly attributed and referenced, right?
Absolutely. And more, of course, these things will be flagged automatically if there is any plagiarism. There are automated tools that do this, so it's spotted very, very quickly. I'd say to authors, use quotation marks if you're making an extended quote. And there are cases, for example, when you're quoting from guidelines, you know, very carefully written guidelines, treatment guidelines, where you really don't want to change the wording and you really do need to quote it verbatim. So in those cases, put quotation marks around and correctly cite the reference.
Let's take a break. I'm Peter Hoffland, and this is the Youngest in Brief.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Start your day the right way with Revive Active's range of super supplements and get the most out of life. Take one power-packed sachet, mix with water, and enjoy a super tasty health drink at work, at home, or on the go. Clean, premium ingredients scientifically formulated to work in synergy to optimize your health and well-being to support immunity, energy, joints, heart health, and more. No filler, no stimulants, no artificial colours or preservatives. Just the right mix of vitamins, minerals, amino acids and hero ingredients to help you put back what life takes out. Try our 7-day or 30-day boxes and use code UKRADIO to get a free supplement shaker. Revive Active. Super supplements for a super you.
Nature's Medicine for Modern Living, a people and plants dialogue hosted by Sophie.Health. At Sophie, we bring together experts and voices who rarely cross paths. Our quest is to illuminate the ancient world of plant medicine and reimagine it for the connected age. Join us to explore new boundaries of digital personalized medicine with deep roots in the natural world. And hear from our community of international pioneers who are validating this new paradigm and improving how we feel, sleep, and cope with daily stresses naturally. Sophie.Health, reconnecting people and plants.
Once upon a time, human slavery was just a fact of life. Right now, animal abuse is often considered normal. In time, it won't be. Animal Aid campaigns peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promotes cruelty-free living.
Check out animalaid.org.uk. It's time for a kinder world.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
This is the Ocazine Brief on UK Health Radio, your real feel-good radio, with Peter Hoffland.
And welcome back. This is the Ocazine Brief. If you're just joining us in today's episode of the Ocazine Brief, I'm talking with Paul Lavender. Now, in the next phase, say that the paper passes the initial checks, right? What happens in the next phase?
So generally, then in the next phase, it would leave the editorial office manager and then go to the editor-in-chief of the journal. They would make a decision on whether to send that paper for external peer review. And they would make that decision based on really three things. The first is a more detailed look at the scope of the paper. Is this paper really matching what my journal is about? So to give an example, at Cargill, we have an audiology journal. But somehow it started to move much more into the cochlear implantation specialty. So we've got a lot of papers on cochlear implantation as a result. So the editor would really ask, okay, is that on oncology, which of course you're covering, there's so many subsections or subfields of oncology, it's important to look at what the journal is most interested in. Is there a particular type of therapy, diagnosis, or so forth? So the editor will say, okay, is this really what I want my journal to publish on? Is it in scope? Then the second question they'll ask is about the potential impact of the paper. So obviously, editors of very high impact journals, such as we said with Nature, New England, or the more specialized journals will look at this paper and say, is it likely to have a scientific impact that is comparable to the reputation of my journal? So if you read a paper in a high impact journal, you would expect it to have potential scientific impact and be cited to perhaps change the research landscape in some way.
Or it may change medical practice, right? I mean, practice-changing developments or findings are often published in those high-caliber journals, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's the question that the editors of those journals would be asking when they look at a submitted paper. But of course, the generally regarded measure of impact is impact factor, which is the average number of citations to papers in a given journal. So if as an author you want to know how high is the bar for me to reach this impact criteria, then looking at the journal's impact factor is a good way to judge. Journals such as Nature have impact factors around 50, but depending on the solid impact factor for most biomedical sciences could be around the 3 to 5 mark would be a good steady impact factor. But in some specialized fields, even impact factors of 1 can actually be credible within that field. So that definition of impact is very field specific.
So it really depends on the journal and on the target audience and the subject matter.
Yes, yep, very much. So for context, you know, I used to work within the cytopathology field, and you would find that the highest impact cytopathology in a journal was around 4, and studies that were seen as very impactful would often get submitted to cancer journals because they had a higher impact factor.
Right.
The other question that the editor would be asking themselves, this is more of a concern for journals with a limited print space, is not just is this paper in scope and not just is it impactful, but is it more impactful than the other submissions that are on my table? So an editor will have to if it's not an open access journal or an online only journal, they will have a limited number of articles that they can publish. If it's still a journal that functions with subscriptions, that may be, for example, 6-8 articles per issue. So your article not only has to be impactful and of the right scope, it also has to be judged better for that readership than all of the other submissions that the editor is considering.
So these aspects are all key in getting a paper past the first inspection by the journal. But then, one of the most difficult parts of getting the paper published is the peer review process. As a side note, most publishers generally don't employ people who are doing this review. Reviewers are often external, independent, and experts in their field, often the key opinion leaders or KOLs who really know the subject matter well and offer their opinion to the publisher to either go ahead and publish or not to publish. So tell me a little bit more about that.
Sure. So the external peer reviewers, so external means external to the editor and to the editorial board. And as publishers, we're obliged to find external peer reviewers to stop the journal itself becoming a kind of echo chamber of the ideas of the editor and the editorial board. So external peer review is obliged, and part of it's mandatory from databases like Medline and Web of Science that this is performed. That is an integral part of having a journal listed within the respected scientific databases. So peer reviewers are often found through editorial board knowing or recommending people who are specialized in the particular field of the paper. They can also be found we're seeing more and more through AI tools that are able to see who's published recently on similar papers within that field.
So an external peer reviewer who reviews a paper also receives instructions from the publisher, which are similar but not necessarily the same as the editorial scope. As mentioned earlier, based on the verdict of the external reviewers, the journal can go ahead and publish the paper, decides not to publish it, or ask the author to review the comments from the peer reviewers and update or change some of the content, right?
Yep, that's right. So I think the guidance given by publishers varies slightly from publisher to publisher. Cargo, we actually offer all of our peer reviewers a collection of two courses on how to perform a review of a clinical paper and how to perform a review of a systematic review. So we offer those courses. And essentially what the peer reviewers are looking for, if we break it down into section, the traditional IMRAD sections of an article, so the introduction, method, results, and discussion. In the introduction section, the peer reviewers are really asking, okay, is there a clear problem statement? Is there actually a real unanswered scientific question that this study is going to answer that will actually have relevance and meaning when it's answered? And the literature review that's building up to that question, is that up to date? And is it still valid? So in the introduction section, the peer reviewer really wants to know, okay, you performed a study. Does that study answer a relevant, interesting question that has not yet been answered? Then when the peer reviewer looks at the method section, they're really asking, okay, you raised the question in the introduction. Now you're saying how you're going to answer this question. Does your proposed solution to answering that question actually fit with the question you've answered? Have you designed an experiment that is credible and will lead meaningful data to answer the question that you asked at the beginning? Then, of course, they'll look through the results, and they're looking at things like any inconsistencies in the data, anything that doesn't perhaps make sense, unclear tables or figures. And then in the discussion, the peer reviewers are really looking at, first of all, do the conclusions that the authors are matching, are they valid conclusions based on the data and the results presented? And as the authors try to explain how their results fit into the wider literature, have they done a complete literature review? And is their interpretation of how these results should fit into the literature correct? Or do the reviewers agree with that?
Without a doubt, reviewing a paper as a peer reviewer is pretty hard. It's not just hard, it's a lot of work.
Yeah, I think it was Publons who did a survey, and they said the average review time was about 4 hours. But of course, within that 4 hours, that's a mean, and there's a pretty big range.
We already talked a little bit about this, but with the previous information in mind, how easy is it to get things published in today's world? How easy is it to get past the editor-in-chief and the peer reviewers and anybody who is involved in the process?
I would say if the problem statement and the methodology are good, it is relatively easy to get published. I mean, we live in an age now where journals, particularly online journals, are not concerned with space. They're not confined by the old print limitations of 6 to 10 articles per issue. They can publish as many papers as they want to. So in that way, that's much easier to get published. And I've seen editors in my time as a publication manager really bend over backwards to help authors when those authors had performed a study that was answering a genuine scientific need in their field. The methodology was correct, and they just needed some help with presenting the data or interpreting the data. So I would say the things that kill a study from being published are generally the methodology and the problem statement. Those are the things that just can't be fixed. So if you get those things right in the beginning, I would say it's easier than it's ever been to be published and to get your work published in a solid, reputable peer-reviewed journal.
So as I mentioned in the beginning of the program, we're both working for academic and medical publishers, and everything seems to be logic and reasonable, right? But as far as you know, are all publishers in the scientific or medical community applying this?
Yes. I mean, I would say, of course, we've had journals that are online only, open access, mega journals. PLOS would be a good example of a journal that says very specifically, we do not promote impact factor, and we do not accept or reject. Our only criteria for acceptance and rejection is scientific soundness. So in that particular case, you would say, well, it would be easier to be published in that journal than it would be to publish in Nature or a journal that really also emphasizes and is expected to emphasize impact.
Let's take a break. I'm Peter Hoffland, and this is the Youngest in Brief.
Clinical trials allow researchers to introduce new hope by providing participants access to cutting-edge and potentially life-saving treatments. Speak with your doctor and visit standuptocancer.org/clinicaltrials to learn more. Together, we can stand up for all of us.
This is the Oncozine Brief on UK Health Radio, your real feel-good radio with Peter Hoffland.
And welcome back. This is the Oncozine Brief. If you're just joining us in today's episode of the Oncozine Brief, I'm talking with Paul Lavender. From an author's perspective, and we discussed this already a bit, if you're planning to write a paper, a manuscript for publishing, the first thing to do is to make sure that your paper will fit the editorial scope of the journal, right? How would you go about that?
There are several steps and several avenues. The first is to really look at that study question. When you ask a study question, you'll also do a literature search to check that the study question hasn't already been answered. And as a result of that literature search, you should find journals that are publishing in that area. You should also, most researchers will have access to databases like Web of Science and so forth, where you can search by categories and see which journals are listed within that particular branch of science or medical field, and narrow down your scope there. And you'll also have an idea of the potential impact of the results. And that should give you an idea of the impact factor that you should be aiming for. So within that, you've got the field, potential impact, and that should really help you and looking at journals that have published similar papers on a similar topic within their recent history. So that should narrow down the search. But there are new initiatives, such as registered reports, which is a lot of journals are starting to accept now, including some cargo journals. And within these, the author writes essentially the introduction and the methodology before performing the study, submits to the journal. And if the journal says, you know what, actually the problem statement's great and the methodology will answer that problem statement, then the journal will commit to publishing the results as long as the methodology has been followed. So you have a pre-acceptance from the journal before you perform the study. And of course, that's very interesting for a lot of authors and particularly for funders who would like to ensure that the funding money they're providing actually results in the publication.
That is, I think, a very good point, because there is a lot of work that needs to be done to get a paper published, right? And if you're on the receiving end of a letter from the publisher that starts with, I'm sorry, but we're not going to publish your paper, that might be very demoralizing, right? Not a very good feeling. Now, so far, we've talked a lot about the publishers, about the editors, about the peer reviewers. But for writers, the authors, it really comes down to a lot of preparation, a lot of hard work, right? To do their homework, look at the editorial scope and the requirements of the journal, and maybe use a professional medical writer to help them in the process. And it brings me to an often heard but sensitive point, that of ghostwriters. And I'm not necessarily talking about medical writers, because in some point of my career, I was also a medical writer. But I'm talking about a situation where researchers do the research, don't write the paper, but have somebody else do the heavy lifting, someone who does not take the credit for it, and somebody who is never mentioned. How do you look at that?
Yeah, I actually was one of the medical writers who, for some point in my career, where I would write industry sponsor. I would write up studies that had been sponsored by industry. So this the practice of ghostwriting, the term certainly is very frowned upon, but the actual profession of medical writing is completely valid and reputable. So you have associations such as the American Association of Medical Writers, the European Association of Medical Writers, and generally what medical writers, as I did, what these people do is they are really like an author's assistant. So you can look at the data, you discuss the data with the authors, and then you start to put this into an outline, and then immediate feedback from the authors, then expand to a first draft based on their feedback, and then send off a feedback again until it gets to the stage where all the authors have reviewed and approved of the paper. And as you said, Peter, a lot of the hard work is in things like if you submit to one journal, you're rejected and you go to another journal, maybe you have to reformat the whole reference list. Maybe you have to shorten sections by hundreds of words. There's a lot of, can be a lot of administrative work, and medical writers can help a lot with that. Normally, all reputable medical writing firms will follow the good publication practice guidelines. When I was doing this, it was GPP3, but I think there's been an update in the meantime. And that states very clearly how medical writers and industry clients should work together to produce a piece of scientifically credible and sound writing.
There are, of course, people that argue that the actual writing of a manuscript submitted to a peer-reviewed journal should be done by the researchers themselves. They believe this is important because part of publishing a paper relies on both the journal's and the author's reputation. Some go even a step further by suggesting that ghostwriting is an academic and scientific misconduct and is unethical. But having a legitimate, and that is the key point here, a legitimate and trained medical writer to assist the research team is very acceptable, right? And while medical writers are not necessarily included as an author or not included in the author's list, they are generally mentioned as contributing to the final article. But medical writers may also help in the handling of some of the activities of the peer review process, suggesting improvements to the manuscript based on the target journal's requirements, as well as formatting, correcting errors, and enhancing the language of the manuscript, right? So using a medical writer, a legitimate medical writer and not a ghostwriter, is a perfectly good practice to consider for someone who did do the research, developed a draft manuscript, but simply needs to have someone help in finalizing the process, right?
Absolutely. Obviously, very often the authors, particularly of large studies, are incredibly busy people. It just makes perfect sense that somebody takes on the burden of actually writing the paper, and that allows them to focus their effort and energies and limited time on a careful review of the paper and feedback at each stage. Also, as well, I think from experience, often you have authors who are particularly strong in certain aspects of the paper and less. And as a medical writer whose function is more like a project manager, you often have a bigger overview or a large overview, and you can point out to the different authors, well, you said this in the introduction, but that's not exactly how it's phrased in the discussion. You can flag these things that may otherwise have been missed to put together, I think, a much better paper.
So again, it's just a team that you can get together. Now, let's go back to the peer review part of the publishing process. Peer review is the golden standard, right? Now, you've referred to a crisis within the peer review community. What do you mean, and what is this crisis?
Yeah, at the moment, and it's been building up for a long time over the last decade, essentially it's harder and harder to find peer reviewers because the volume of scientific output is exceeding the number of peer reviewers. Intuitively, this makes no sense because you say, well, the more people that are writing, then the more people can review. But editors, understandably, and editorial boards tend to trust reviewers that they know and have worked with before. And as a lot of journals are very Western oriented and obviously in the English language, then for Western reviewers and reviewers working in English tend to be asked more often. than reviewers who may be based in an Asian country and are not so familiar to the editors or the editorial boards. But a lot of the scientific output, particularly from China at the moment, there's a huge increasing amount of output coming from those regions that needs review. So this was covered, I think, in a Publons report back in 2017. And anecdotally, I think I can confirm that it's still very difficult and increasingly difficult for publishers to find reviewers simply due to the amount that's being asked of them.
Well, that is something we've encountered as well with finding peer reviewers for our flagship journal, ADC Review, Journal of Antibody Drug Conjugates. In general, I think that it is something very difficult to do, not only to get people that understand the whole industry and the whole topic, but are people that are really recognized as experts in this area, right?
It's a really good point. And I think the other thing you've hit upon there is the more complex the research. And we see this with a lot of translational and interdisciplinary research. You have reviewers that come back and say, well, I can review the methods section, but you'll need somebody else to take this part and somebody else to take this part. And as research becomes more complex, then necessarily the review becomes more complex. And sometimes we're finding for some of our journals, very interdisciplinary ones, you almost need five reviewers from different areas to give the paper a thorough review. And of course, that lends to a lot of delays in the timelines.
But in the end, the result is good. Let's switch gears a little bit and talk a little bit about artificial intelligence and AI. It's a buzzword we hear almost every day. How does AI play a role in the peer review process? And maybe going a step further, if you're interested in publishing a paper, can I have AI write that paper for me?
Yeah. These are all very, very topical questions. And let's take the peer review one first. Can AI peer review a paper? A lot of publishers are, including ourselves, are testing and just doing some checks. But the important thing is which AI and which environment. So, for example, I think it was the NHS in England that actively prohibited all of their staff who'd been asked to peer review a paper from uploading sections of that paper to, I think it was GPT-3 at the time, because of confidentiality concerns. You didn't know where those data were going, and the data at that point in the process is confidential. So the initial testing seems to be that indicate that AI can flag some issues. You can train AI to say, these are the guidelines of the journal. This is the paper. Can you tell us any differences between the two? And this is being used in that first line review that we talked about already that's done by the editorial office manager. And several platforms exist that can be used by publishers to have the first read of a paper done by AI to flag. So it's basically a human assistant. It augments the editorial office manager's work. It flags things to make their review easier. In terms of the in-depth peer review that would be done, my understanding is we're certainly not there yet. It is in no way able to replace the human reviewer, particularly in terms of things like that only a clinician would know whether something would be clinically plausible and not just statistically plausible. However, I certainly believe more and more we'll see AI used in peer review, particularly considering the peer review crisis that we spoke about. It will become necessary for more use in the first line review. The other point you mentioned was AI as an author. And of course, a lot of people are very interested in this because, you know, we're now seeing Copilot with the Microsoft AI, which is based on GPT-4. Rolled out into Word and Excel. So whereas just a few months ago, if you wanted to get AI to write a paper for you, you would have had to go to your AI tool and give it instructions. Now it may well be that you start writing your paper in Word and suddenly the equivalent of Clippy is knocking on your screen saying, hi, I see you're writing a paper on this topic. Shall I help you? So more and more, that will become part of the workflow. And The STM, the Scientific Technical Medical Publishers Association, has given some guidance on the use of AI by authors. And what they basically say is, look, if an author uses basic support to correct, edit, format, that's fine, and they don't need to disclose anything. If they use AI beyond basic editing and text help, then they should put a disclosure necessary in the acknowledgements or the disclosure section of the paper. However, authors should not use AI to create, alter, manipulate original data and results, including images. And AI cannot be an author. And the reason for that is one of the criteria for authorship is to take responsibility and accountability for the work. And of course, AI is not able to do that.
So while AI offers a lot of benefits as supporting tools in writing a scientific, medical, or academic paper, there are still limitations, right? In general, while these AI-based tools can help draft abstracts or suggest research directions, they are a work in progress. And they may, to some extent, have progressed to the point that they may indeed help academic researchers to analyze and write a scientific paper and brainstorm concepts and ideas. They are just tools, not a replacement of the human being behind the study or the manuscript.
Absolutely, absolutely, very, very much.
Another important point is that of copyright infringement. AI may be able to recognize copyright infringement, but it can also be the source of it if it suggests to incorporate certain materials without properly attributing or referencing this, right? Let's take a break. I'm Peter Hofland, and this is The Jonkersin Brief.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Delightful news, air travelers. Going in and out of airports without getting sick can be challenging. Time to take charge of the air you breathe with Nasal Guard. Nasal Guard topical gel defends by blocking harmful airborne particles and viruses. Try Nasal Guard for air travelers today. Visit Amazon or nasalguard.co.uk to learn more about Nasal Guard spray and gel products. Again, that's nasalguard.co.uk.
Apples and pears, beef and skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries and cream.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens, and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
This is the Ocazine Brief on UK Health Radio, your real feel-good radio with Peter Hofland.
And welcome back. This is the Oncogene Brief. If you're just joining us in today's episode of the Oncogene Brief, I'm talking with Paul Lavender. We're almost at the end of the program, and if you listen to the program, you may have additional questions. You may have other questions for us, right? So please submit those questions to us and let us know what you think about what you've heard today. I think we can at least, and I think Paul would agree with that, fill another hour of the program. But in summary, some of the things that we've discussed, if someone submits a manuscript to a journal and that manuscript or paper is accepted by the editor-in-chief, as well as the editorial board and the peer reviewers, the authors may see their paper published in a reputable peer-reviewed journal. That's number one. But you also mentioned that for some academic and scientific journals, the non-acceptance rate is up to 80%, in some cases even up to 95%, right? So if a manuscript is not accepted for publishing, what are you going to do with that material? Are you allowed to use that for another journal?
Okay, so let's look at the first one. So let's say the paper goes on to be accepted by a journal. So the peer reviewers, just for clarification, the peer reviewers can't make the decision to accept or reject a paper. The peer reviewers can recommend to the editor, and normally the recommendations are accept, major revision required, minor revision required, or reject. And the peer reviewer should make their recommendation, followed by the justification for that recommendation. And the editor will make the final decision when all of the peer reviewers, and generally you'd use at least two, ideally three peer reviewers per paper, when those recommendations come together. And if there's any discrepancy with the recommendations, then the editor would have to consider those and resolve them. So the question is, once the paper's been accepted, it's then published within the journal, can the author reuse that material? And the answer is, it depends a lot on what copyright license was signed. So traditionally, authors would sign a transfer of copyright agreement to the publisher. And that meant that the author was no longer the copyright holder of that work, and therefore not able to copy and paste large amounts of text without first checking with the publisher and obtaining a release of the copyright for that use. Now, most publishers are lenient around things like the methods, where you often have big chunks of text copied verbatim because the methodology is the same. But things like the discussion and the introduction, publishers are less lenient upon this, around these areas where it's more unique intellectual contributions. So that's a traditional model. But obviously we're seeing, particularly on oncology, a huge percentage of papers now being published under an open access model. And when an author publishes under an open access model, they have to choose a Creative Commons license. And these Creative Commons licenses, there are several to choose from, and some are extremely lenient, particularly CC0, where basically that allows anybody to do anything with that work, including the authors. And then they go progressively more restrictive. So an author could say, okay, I don't want anybody to change the work. They can copy it, but they cannot change it. Or I don't want my work to be used for any commercial use. So obviously you mentioned you have some industry listeners to the podcast. So generally with industry-sponsored studies, we find that most insist that it's published without any commercial restrictions, so that industry clients are then able to reuse any figures and so forth in subsequent symposia that they may be organizing around a paper.
Now, the other major question is, if the paper is not accepted, what are the options for the authors then?
If the paper is not accepted, then the publisher who's rejected has no rights at all to any of the content, so the author's free to do with it what they will. As an author with a rejected paper, then I think the first thing you have to look at is saying, okay, why was this paper rejected? If it was a question of, well, the scope of the journal was wrong, or I aimed too high with impact or reputation of the journal, but they didn't find any scientific flaws, or they didn't say that the data were invalid or that the study question had already been answered or anything like that, then it's relatively simple to look for a journal that has perhaps a lower impact and to resubmit to that journal. The only stipulation is that authors must not submit to more than one journal simultaneously, that really only one submission at a time, and most publishers, or probably almost all publishers, will have the journal, the authors tick a box to confirm that this paper is not under consideration by any other journal.
Well, that is a lot of information. Now, if people would like to get more information about the whole publishing process, right, where can they find more information?
Indeed, yes. A lot of the information that we covered here was actually put into a two-hour e-learning course, which I developed with Encarga. Normally, this is one that we normally offer to subscribers of the journals and universities, but there's a $29 fee to access the course. So for listeners of OncoZyn, we'd like to waive that fee and put on a coupon code so they can access that course free of charge.
I'm sure that our listeners are interested in exploring this option. Paul Lavender, thank you so much for joining me today in the OncoZyn Brief. I really appreciate your time in explaining how the peer review process in publishing actually works. I'm looking forward to having you back and talk a little bit more about some of the questions that people are hopefully going to submit and some of the other things that we've not discussed yet, right? But for now, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Peter. I really enjoyed it.
In this episode of the OncoZyn Brief, I spoke with Paul Lavender. Paul is head of education at Karger Publishers, based in the Basel area in Switzerland. And in today's program, we spoke about publishing manuscripts based on research studies in academic or scientific papers or in a medical peer-reviewed journal. For more information about Karger, please visit the company's website at karger.com. That is KARGER.com. If you're interested in the two-hour e-learning course Paul mentioned in the program, please visit us at OncoZyn.com. That is OncoZyn.com. Now, keep in mind that for this e-learning course, there is normally a $29 fee to access the course. But for listeners to the OncoZyn Brief, Karger has waived this fee. So make sure that you get a coupon code so you can access this course free of charge. For us here at the OncoZyn Brief, we want to thank you, our listeners, sponsors, and advertisers, for your ongoing support. Your support makes it possible that you can hear this program via PRX, Public Radio Exchange, and in the United Kingdom and mainland Europe via UK Health Radio. And starting this month, the OncoZyn Brief is also available via Southwest Public Radio. You can also download our program via podcast and streaming media, including iTunes, Spotify, Audible, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and nearly anywhere you can find a podcast. If you're living in the United States and want to receive our newsletter, text the word cancer to 66866. That is 66866. And we will make sure that you'll receive our newsletter, which includes an overview of the latest news in oncology and hematology. And if you like what we do and want to support the OncoZyn Brief, visit our website at OncoZyn.com. That is OncoZyn.com. Here you'll find more information about how to join as an individual sponsor or as a corporate sponsor or advertiser. Now, support for the OncoZyn Brief comes from the Oncology Directory at OncologyDirectory.com, as well as from the ADC Directory at ADCDirectory.com, and from listeners like you. Thank you all, and thank you for listening, and join us again for our next episode. I'm Peter Hoffland, and this is the OncoZyn Brief.
The OncoZyn Brief is a global medical educational service from the publishers of OncoZyn and ADC Review, the journal of antibody drug conjugates. Support for the OncoZyn Brief comes from our commercial underwriters and advertisers and the listeners to this station. For more information about advertising, underwriting, and sponsoring options, visit OncoZyn at www.OncoZyn.com/podcasts. The OncoZyn Brief contains health and medicine-related information and is provided for educational and entertainment purposes only. The content in this program is not intended as a substitute for professional medical or health advice and does not replace your doctor's advice and guidance. Your doctor is the best person to answer questions about your personal health. If you hear something in this program that doesn't agree with what your doctor has told you, ask him or her about it.